Welcome to the Dublin City Public Libraries and Archives podcast. In this episode, Danielle McLaughlin and Roisin O'Donnell read from their collections and discuss their creative writing process. Recorded at the Central Library on the 7th of April 2017 as part of its Contemporary Irish Literature series.
Thanks so much for coming in today. It's such a lovely sunny day outside as well. I was saying to Danielle, we should have had this outside in the park. Could have been better. So we're just going to sort of introduce each other, and we're each going to read a little bit from our short stories, and then we'll be discussing various aspects of the writing process, and then there'll be a chance for anyone to ask questions if you'd like to. So just to introduce Danielle, Danielle McLaughlin is an award-winning short story writer. If you have time to read the list of all the awards that Danielle has won, there's plenty of them. The William Trevor and Elizabeth Bowen International Short Story Awards, the Williamston Herald International Short Story Prize, and many others. And she's recently been longlisted for the Edge Hill Short Story Prize as well. Danielle's collection, Dinosaurs on Other Planets, was published by the Sting and Fly Press in 2015. So I'm going to let Danielle read you from her collection.
Hello everybody, it's lovely to be reading here today, and thanks to Anne and to everyone at the library for the invitation. I'm going to read an extract from the title story of my collection, Dinosaurs on Other Planets. My short stories tend not to be particularly short, they're actually quite long stories, so I'm going to read a little bit from the middle. Just to let you know a few things then that you might like to be aware of about the characters, to bring us up to the point where we're joining them in the story. We have a couple in this story called Kate and Coleman. Kate is in middle age, and Coleman, her husband, is a good deal older. There is some tension in their marriage. Their daughter, Emer, has just arrived home from London at short notice, and she's brought her son, Oisin, who's their only grandchild, with her. And it's only when the car pulls up in front of the house that they realise she has also brought somebody else with her, a new man who's roughly twice her age and who they've never met before. His name is Pavel. And we're going to join them now when Coleman and his grandson have gone for a walk in a nearby forest, and Emer and Pavel have gone to the pub, and Kate is in the kitchen waiting for their return. An hour later, her husband and grandson returned, clattering into the kitchen. Oisin's shoes and the ends of his trousers were covered in mud. He was carrying something, cradling it to his chest. And when she went to help him off with his shoes, she saw it was an animal skull. Coleman went out to the utility room and rummaged around in the presses, knocking over pans and brushes, banging doors. "What are you looking for?" she said, but he disappeared outside to the yard. The boy remained in the kitchen, stroking the skull as if it were a kitten. It was yellowy white and long-nosed with a broad forehead. Coleman returned with a plastic bucket and a 5-gallon drum of bleach. He took the skull from the boy and placed it in the bucket, poured the bleach on top until it reached the rim. The boy looked on in awe. "Now," Coleman said, "that'll clean up nicely. Leave it a couple of days and you'll see how white it is." "Look," the boy said, grabbing Kate's hand and dragging her over. "We found a dinosaur skull." "A sheep, more likely," his grandfather said. "A sheep that got caught in wire. The dinosaurs were killed by a meteorite millions of years ago." Kate peered into the bucket. Little black things, flies perhaps, had already detached themselves from the skull and were floating loose. There was green around the eye sockets, and veins of mud drained deep from the bone. "What's a meteorite?" the boy said. The front door opened, and they heard Emer and Pavel coming down the hall. child doesn't know what a meteorite is, Coleman said when they entered the kitchen. Emer rolled her eyes at her mother. She sniffed and wrinkled her nose. It smells like a hospital in here, she said. Pavel dropped to his haunches beside the bucket. What's this? He said. It's a dinosaur skull, Machine said. So it is, Pavel said. Kate waited for her husband to contradict him, but Coleman had settled into an armchair in the corner, holding a newspaper at chest height in front of him. She looked down at the top of Pavel's head, noticed how his hair had the faintest suggestion of a curl, how a tuft went its own way at the back. The scent of his shampoo was sharp and sweet and spiced like an orange pounder. She looked away, out to the garden, and saw that the evening was fading. I'm going to get some herbs, she said, before it's too dark. And taking a scissors and a basket, she went outside. She cut parsley first, then thyme, brushing away small insects that crept over her hands, scolding the cat when it thrust its head in the basket. Inside the house, someone switched down the lights. From the dusk of the garden, she watched figures move about the kitchen, a series of family tableaux framed by floral curtained windows. Now Coleman and Oisin, now Oisin and Emer, sometimes Emer and Pavel. Every so often she heard a sudden burst of laughter. Back inside, she found Coleman, Oisin and Pavel gathered around a box on the table, an old cardboard potato box from upstairs. She put the herbs in a colander by the sink and went over to the table. Overhead, water rattled through the house's antiquated pipes, the sound of Emer running a bath. From the box, Coleman took dusty school reports, a metal truck with its front wheels missing, a tin of toy soldiers. Aha, he said, I knew we kept it. He lifted out a long cylinder of paper and tapped it playfully against the top of Oisin's head. I'm going to show you what a meteorite looks like, he said. She watched as Coleman unfurled the paper and laid it flat on the table. It curled back into itself and he reached for a couple of books from a nearby shelf, positioning them at the top and bottom to hold it in place. It was a poster, 4 feet long and 2 feet wide. This here, Coleman said, is the asteroid belt. He traced a circular pattern in the middle of the poster, and when he took away his hand, his fingertips were grey with dust. Pavel moved aside to allow Kate a better view. She peered over her husband's shoulder into the vastness of space. A dazzling galaxy of stars and moons and dust. It was dizzying, the sheer scale of it, the unimaginable expanses of space and time, the vast spinning universe. We are there, she thought, if only we could see ourselves. We are there, and so are the Dennehys, so is John in Japan. The poster had once hung in her son's bedroom. It was wrinkled, torn at the edges, but intact. She looked at the planets, pictured them spinning and turning all those years beneath the stairs, their moons in odd orbit. She was reminded of a music box from childhood that she had happened upon years later in her mother's attic. She had undone the catch, lifted the lid, and miraculously, the little ballerina had begun to turn. The netting of her skirt torn and yellowed, but her arms moving in time to the music nonetheless. This is our man, Coleman said, pointing to the top left-hand corner. This is the fellow that did for the dinosaurs. The boy was on tiptoe, gazing in wonder at the poster. He touched the finger to the thing Coleman had indicated, a flaming ball of rock throwing dust and comets. Did it only hit planet Earth? Yes, its grandfather said. Wasn't that enough? It's so there could still be dinosaurs on other planets. No, Holden said, at exactly the same time the Vell said, very likely. The boy turned to the Vell. Really? I don't see why not, the Vell said. There are millions of other galaxies and billions of other planets. I bet there are lots of other dinosaurs, maybe lots of other people too. Like aliens, the boy said. Yes, aliens, if you want to call them that, the Vell said, although they might be very like us. Coleman lifted the books from the ends of the poster and it rolled back into itself with a slam of dust. He handed it to Oisin, then returned the rest of the things to the box, closing down the cardboard flaps. Okay, Sonny, he said, let's put this back on the stairs. And the boy followed him out of the kitchen, the poster tucked under his arm like a musket.
If you just said something, I didn't hear what it was.
Kate refused all offers of help. She sent everyone to the sitting room to play cards, while she cleared the table and took the dishes to the sink. Three red lights shone down from the mountain, the nighttime lights of the wind turbines, a warning to aircraft. She filled the sink with soapy water and watched the bubbles form psychedelic honeycombs, millions and millions of tiny domes glittering on the dirty crates. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce Roisin O'Donnell. It's a joy to be reading with Roisin today. I'm a great fan of her work, and Wild Quiet was one of my favourite reads of 2016. There's great energy and beauty and innovation in Roisin's writing, and I'm in awe of the way that she weaves between countries and languages and even other dimensions as she tells her stories. Roisin's short stories have appeared in a wide range of publications, including the Young Irelanders Anthology and also the anthologies A Long Ways Back and The Glass Shore. Wild Quiet was shortlisted for the Kate O'Brien Award. And Roisin is going to read for us.
Thanks, Danielle. It's an honour to be reading alongside Danielle. I've been reading her stories for years and kind of in awe, so I can't believe I'm here today, actually. I was looking through the collection last night trying to decide which story to read from, and I picked out this one that seemed particularly kind of relevant to my life at the moment. We've just had our first baby. Our little baby girl is 7 weeks old. And this story seemed particularly relevant. I suppose the funny thing is about having the baby, you presume that you know this little person, you've carried her for 9 months and you presume that you know her, but then the baby comes along and you're strangers to each other, really, and you spend the first few weeks trying to get to know each other. And this story really is about that situation and about a family who discover that their daughter is literally from another realm. So this is Infinite Landscapes. Abayomi had always known I wasn't destined to stay in this world. The young Simidele wrote on the back of a cereal box in looping purple ink. Even as a child, Simi was in the habit of noting down her experiences, never suspecting that 30 years later, I would use her box of scraps to piece together the legend of my origins. Simi's writings, along with Abayomi's memories and the cuttings I've pasted in my scrapbook over the years, have allowed me to reconstruct a narrative of sorts. And when friends ask why I waste so much time trying to put together Simi's story, my usual response is to shrug and tell them, if you don't know your roots, then you can't understand where you're coming from. Abayomi was my grandmother. She was a proud Yoruba woman with a high forehead and an obsession with the music of the chieftains. Memories of her evoke the caramelized fragrance of frying plantains, the ripple of Irish reels from the kitchen, the tropical flowers of her jelly head wraps. She left Nigeria for Ireland in her early 20s and started work as a nurse at St. James's Hospital. There she met my granddad, Cathal O'Doherty, a plumber from Dunleary, who landed in at A&E one morning with his left leg scalded from a boiler incident. He could cheat with the devil, my grandmother told me. There he was, in a right state, blisters all over, but that didn't stop him from asking me out to a dance. My grandparents married soon after, settled on Tivoli Avenue, and started planning a family. Years of heartache followed. Time after time, we visited the early pregnancy unit at the Rotunda. Time after time, the monitor showed nothing but darkness floating around inside Abayomi's womb, the watery oblong of a pregnancy sac with nothing inside it. There were always the same words of consolation. Not to worry, love. You'll have another one soon. You'll be back in here before Christmas. The same room in the Rotunda, reserved for moments of shock, disappointment, grief. The same cups of milky tea. And then the long drive home to Dunleary, silence gathering between them like the stillness before snowfall. This cyclical pattern was eventually shattered when my grandmother came home one winter evening, slammed the door behind her and shouted, "Cathal, we have a heartbeat." Her hands trembled as she told them about the scan she had, the pregnancy she kept secret. Elated, the couple splashed out and ordered Domino's pizza for dinner. But later, when they settled on the sofa for the evening, Abayomi pressed pause on the remote and put her hand on Cathal's knee. "Love," she said, "this won't be a normal baby." On screen, a blonde girl was paused open-mouthed in her soaring rendition of "Wind Beneath My Wings." Cathal took his wife's hand and gave it a squeeze. "What do you mean, not normal, love? I've always said I'd love any child that we..." "No." Her black eyes watered into inky pools. "This child will be a Biku." "It'll be what?" "Cursed," she hiccuped. "A child of the spirits." Cathal kissed her forehead. "Ach, love, that's just quaint old superstition, so it is." Just then the TV unpaused itself and the blonde girl soared into her chorus. Tutting, as if the singer had offended her personally, Abayomi repaused the telly and threw the remote down so hard that the battery fell out and rolled under the sofa. She folded her arms across her chest. "Cathal, there is nothing quaint about a spirit child." Abayomi was 43 at that time. She'd lived in Ireland for more than half her life, but still held on to her Yoruban beliefs. Whether her baby had been conceived beside the Liffey or in Lagos did not make any difference to my spirited grandmother. Among Yoruba, it was considered serious bad luck for a child to take up residence in the belly of a woman who had lost so many of her children before. So, that night, Abayomi called her mother, Sama Nanosi, on Skype. The wise woman of Kawara crouched over a cola, her dreadlocks brushing against the webcam as she listened to her daughter's story. "Mark my words," Sama Nanosi nodded, "this child will be a Biku, a spirit child predestined to forever come and go." Abayomi came off Skype with a list of tricks and remedies. From that night on, she began leaving a pair of open scissors by her bedside to scare the spirits away. "Don't be daft, love," Cathal said. "Sure, the doctor said everything's grand. There's no need for all this fuss." Abayomi ignored him and polished the scissor blades, her mouth set in a determined line. Sighing, my grandfather left her to it. He busied himself by decorating the spare bedroom with rainbow wallpaper, while in Abayomi's belly, the child grew stronger. And on the day newborn Simi Deli O'Doherty first opened her shocking green eyes in the Rotunda Hospital, my grandmother's suspicions were sadly confirmed. Little Simi burst into life, shuddering and wailing from the scars of past lives barely lived and suffering withdrawal symptoms from the spirit kingdom she left behind. As Abayomi had dreaded, through her umbilical cord, Simi had absorbed the spirits of all the other lost babies gone before. Simmy would never settle in the skin of one personality, but would always be moving, changing from one soul to another. She was fated to be seduced and misguided by the spirits, to read minds and to skip between dimensions, and to be eternally distrusted in a world that fears the unfamiliar. Concerned for the fate of their newest family member, the Yoruban side of Simi's family tried all they could think of to shift the Abiku spirits away from her. Abiomi and Cahill's terraced house on Tivoli Avenue received a constant flow of calls and emails from aunts and cousins in Kawara and Oyo, bearing advice and remedies. Keep away from Iroko, Baobab, and silk cotton trees, a cousin in Kawara advised, becoming offended when Abiomi pointed out that these trees do not exist in Ireland. Sam and Anosi suggested they should avoid trees altogether, because these were the seating places of the spirits. Stay out of bright sunlight, an aunt from Oyo told them, and no crying over the child. Each tear you cry, she will convert for diamonds in the spirit kingdom. Kneeling by Simi's bedside, Abiomi turned to her gods. Leave her be, she implored Olofi, the conduit between heaven and earth. Give her the spark of life, Aye. Allow my daughter to stay. And each afternoon, she wheeled Simi's pram around Dunleary in relentless circles while she tried to discover where the child had hidden her spirit key, an object whose discovery would convince their daughter to stay. But all the incantations to Elu Damare, the late night vigils, and the open scissors left by the child's bedside were to no avail. Each morning, Simi's green eyes would carry glints of the electric dreams she'd woken from. And it was clear as day to anyone present that Simi Delhi O'Doherty was as much an Abiku child as ever. Growing up, I often heard stories of how Simi's youngest years were spent tussling among the spirits, who delighted in playing mind games with the humans. Simi's earliest drawings show the spirits as shapes of colourful light lingering around her. A recurring image shows a spirit in the shape of a cat, its bluish tail curled around Simi's leg, its red eyes flashing. Other pictures show Abiomi's dead babies as soft pink cloud shapes scampering after Simi across the floorboards. Sometimes we see a shadow dashing across the bathroom wall, my granny told me, or would hear a buzz like the frantic flutter of a trapped night moth. Other times I'd step into a patch of warm light, and I'd know there was something there, not quite living, not quite dead, something. Some of my grandparents' tales of spirit mischief have been retold so often that they've worked their way into my memory. I now imagine I was there to witness the events myself. My favourite story is of how Abiomi lulled the downy-haired Simi to sleep in her cot one day, only to find her dozing in the unlit oven a few minutes later. Her face grimy from oven grease, smelling of last night's chicken burgers, the back of her head marked from the oven shelf. Then there's the story of how Cahill locked the front door one night, only to find it wide open the next morning. He still describes the eerie stillness, the soft sea broom seeping around the door. Nothing had been stolen, but a strange sadness had crept into the house like a sea fret. Honest to God, I was almost beginning to believe your granny's stories, my grandfather told me. He was reminded of whispers he heard as a wane of changelings and fairy forts, and he began to view Simi Delhi as a volatile and potentially dangerous gift. So Danielle, and thanks for the reading, that was absolutely brilliant. It's wonderful to hear the stories that have come alive when you hear them read aloud. I love that story. And another one in your collection that I love is called A Different Country. And that takes place in Donegal, which is where I spent quite a bit of my childhood. My mum and dad are from Derry, so we would have spent a lot of time out in the Inishowen Peninsula. And just the setting of that story was so vivid for me. There's a beautiful beach called Kinnegow Bay. and a new story, it just leaps off the page. I was right back there. And I just wanted to ask you about the importance of place in your stories. When you start writing a story, do you know immediately where you want that to be set, or does the setting come later? If you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, the setting arrives quite early on in the story process for me. The setting mightn't be the initial spark, but it arrives very quickly afterwards. Yeah. So in that story that you mentioned, A Different Country, I love Kinnegal Bay. Whenever I'm up in Donegal, I go to visit it. I married a man from the Inishowen Peninsula. And that story actually, just I suppose to give an idea of how the setting came into it, it started out when I read an article in the newspaper that was reviewing Junior MasterChef, that program on TV. It's a cookery competition that very small kids take part in, and they get eliminated when they forget to turn on the cookery or their papers and all stuff like that. And the reviewer said that it was like watching a seal cull, seeing all these little kids being eliminated from the competition. And I thought, wow, watching a seal cull, imagine what that must be like. And once I had that idea, I said, I know exactly where I'm going to set that, because I would have visited the Inishowen Peninsula. I'm not going up to visit my husband's family. So yeah, I had the setting for it then. So it's like, once I have the idea, or once I have a character, I have to give them a stage to work on quite early on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you can kind of visualize the story a lot better, can't you, when you know where it's set and you can see the characters in that place.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I like to work with detail of setting a lot. So I think once I know early on whether I'm by the sea or whether I'm inland, I like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a question that is linked to that very beautiful reading you gave there, and I just loved the Abiku child and the spirit world and all the wonderful details that you have in it, like the scissors beside the bed and staying away from particular kinds of trees. And I've noticed it's something that comes up in your stories a good deal, references to spirits and to ghosts. And I'm wondering, What sparked that interest? Where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, I wrote an article recently for the Books Ireland magazine actually about this, about magical realism, I suppose you could call it, where you have like elements of the supernatural woven into stories. I suppose traditionally maybe Irish short stories would be associated more with realism, really, if you think about Dubliners and the legacy from that. But I've always found it strange that there's not more kind of supernatural elements in Irish stories, because I know for me growing up, we were constantly being told stories and being told stories about anything from supernatural things to ghosts and all sorts. And there's a story in my collection, Ebenezer's Memories, which was inspired by my granddad. He used to always tell us there was a monster living under his stairs. I think it was to stop us from going in the cupboard under the stairs and playing, you know, but he told us there was a monster living under the stairs and his name was Ebenezer, and you weren't to go near him or you'd wake him up, you know. And that was the starting point for me for that story. I had this idea that Ebenezer was this monster living under the stairs and he's actually eating the family's memories. But that came from, as I said, my granddad, and I think just that whole interest in spirits and ghosts, and that really does come from childhood stories and being brought up with this sort of appreciation of, I suppose, magic and that kind of thing.
I have maybe a follow-on question linked to that, because I think, you know, you mentioned that story, Fairy Forts, as well as the alongside the Abiku. So it's this, I suppose, this mixing of different kinds of stories and traditions. And a lot of the stories in your collection, they look at and explore issues of identity and people who are maybe between identities, people who are in a space that maybe they feel like the outsider. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about how your own experience has informed your writing.
Well, you can probably tell from my accent, I'm a bit of a mixture. My mum and dad, as I said, are from Derry, but I grew up in England. I was born over there and grew up there. But we were always sort of thought of Ireland as home. You know, we came home for our summer holidays every year. Even though we lived in England, Ireland was considered home. And when I was 18 then, my dad got a job in Dublin and we all moved over here. And it was quite a surprise to find that this place I had always considered home was actually quite strange to me, and it took a lot of getting used to living in Ireland. It's quite different from living here. It's quite different from being on your holidays, as you can imagine. So I suppose I've always felt maybe a little bit of an outsider in that aspect. I think I have the classic dilemma of being considered Irish when I'm in England and English when I'm in Ireland. So I've always had that sense of being a bit of an outsider. And I think when you're in that situation, you kind of have a choice. You can get really annoyed about it and have a massive chip on your shoulder about it. Or you can kind of embrace your status as a bit of a shapeshifter and really connect with other people who are in that situation too. And also in the collection, as you said, I take on the perspective of quite a few different cultures. I work at my day job as a teacher, and I worked for years out in Blanchardstown in an Educate Together school, and it's very, very multicultural environment, and I was really fascinated to meet kids who would have parents, maybe one Irish parent, one parent from elsewhere, maybe both their parents from elsewhere, and they'd been born in Ireland, and their relationship with Irishness was something that was really, really fascinating to me. So I think that's why I wanted to just explore those perspectives.
Yeah. Will I ask you another question if I can?
Yeah. Something I was interested in the stories is the use of animals. As you've seen in that story, there's the image of the skull, which I think you'll agree is just so vivid, this image of the skull, and it's so dirty and everything. And then there's the seals, as you mentioned. There's quite often animals and images of animals crop up in your stories. They don't tend to fare too well either. And I was just wondering about that. Are you aware of using animals in a metaphorical way? And is that something that is in the early drafts, or does that come in later on?
I wasn't really aware until I got to the end of writing all the stories that I was doing these things to animals all the time. Animals would come into my story, they'd find their way in, and then I'd kill them off. And it was only, you know, quite a few stories in, really, when the collection was published, and people were saying to me, oh my goodness, the things, the poor animals, you know. So I wasn't deliberately bringing them in, but I do know that from way back when I was a very small child at national school age, I had this bit of an obsession, I suppose, with animals and dead animals. And we had a club, myself and one of my brothers and a few of the local kids, called Be Kind to Animals Club. But we only concentrated on dead animals. And I don't remember us ever doing anything for a live animal. But we would go around the room and we would record all the dead ones. And we'd have this little copybook and we'd record, you know, one pigeon and one rabbit. And one day we found a rabbit, and we were really impressed because you could see part of the inside of his tummy. And we took him away for a club activity. We buried him. And then the next week for the club activity, he dug him up again. So always, animals and dead animals have been of interest to me. But I had no idea I was doing that until I had written the whole collection and people started pointing it out to me.
Yeah. It is funny, isn't it, how sometimes you can only see patterns like that after you finish the collection, and the things that are so obvious to readers, and yet sometimes as writers we're not aware of these things at the time of writing. Another theme, I suppose, I noticed, I was wondering, was that deliberate, was in the stories is quite often the theme is sort of breakdown in communication between people. So like in the extract that you read there, there's Kate and her husband Coleman are having obviously massive difficulty in just communicating with each other, and then Kate is having difficulty in communicating with her daughter. And I was wondering, just the struggle to kind of express feelings, is that something that you were aware of when you were writing? Is that something that you wanted to explore?
No, that was another thing that kind of just found its way in of its own accord. And again, it was only when I had a good bunch of stories and I was able to look back over them that I could see themes like that emerging. So I kind of think that's like me seeping into the stories, because, you know, it's so many difficulties in life, I suppose, come down to, you know, trying to communicate effectively with other people and those gaps in communication when communication fails. And that's just the fabric of the writing, I think,
Yeah.
Of my writing. What makes good short stories is about that dilemma.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how the things, as you said, seep into your stories without you realising it. I was listening to an interview with George Saunders, and he was saying that one of the worst things you can do as a writer is to take your big truckload of meaning and kind of dump it on the reader. I think what he meant is being too deliberate. Like if you set out to say, right, I'm going to write a story about breakdown in communication, that if you set out to do it deliberately, it would somehow be like too obvious or too awkward, but that it has to just seep in almost subconsciously without you being aware of it. That's
yeah,
really interesting.
I think so. I love George Saunders. He's just,
yeah,
he's just amazing. And he talks so eloquently and writes so well about writing process too.
He does.
Anytime there's an interview.
Yeah, he does speak very eloquently about it, which is a difficult thing to talk about sometimes.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you another question, if I may. I love the way that you have fragments of languages other than the English language threaded through the stories, and it's really beautiful and it works so well. And I was wondering which of those languages you were familiar with and which of them you had to research.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I learned Spanish when I was at school, and I lived in Spain then for a while when I was in my 20s teaching English. And so Spanish crops up in one of the stories, Under the Jasmine Tree, so I was familiar enough with that. So a lot of the other languages, though, I did have to research. There's a story called Wild Quiet, which is about a little girl from Somalia, and she's at school in Donegal. And for that, I just wanted little fragments. There's a few phrases in Arabic, there's a couple of phrases in a Somali dialect, and I had to actually research that. My reason for putting those in there really was I wanted the reader to kind of experience the feeling of the character, the child in this case, who's kind of caught between languages, yeah? She's, yeah, Arabic, the Somali dialect, and then English, and to kind of get a perspective into her world. So I did have to research that. Luckily, in my job, I work teaching English as a foreign language. I teach students from all over the world and often end up becoming quite friendly with them. And I was able to ask students to give me help with a few phrases and to check things. There's another story in the book, Kamikaze Love, which has a little bit of Japanese in it. And I was able to contact a student from Japan who I was still in touch with and asked him for a translation. But it was funny actually, it kind of showed, I suppose, I don't know, maybe my being a bit arrogant kind of approach to language without meaning to. I emailed my student, Kitaro, and said, Kitaro, I have this sentence, it's just four words in English, can you translate it into Japanese for me? Fine, okay, fine. And he replied back with a list of like 10 different possible interpretations in Japanese. He said, well, do you mean it like this? Do you mean it like this? Do you want like a literary kind of expression? Do you mean this? Do you mean this? And it made me realise, oh gosh, I need to actually, for him to translate this, I need to tell him the story so that he gets the context. So I kind of gave him a little summary of the short story, and he replied back then straight away and was like, yeah, this is the one that you need. So it was really interesting, that process of translation for me. And then there's one story as well that's got bits of Irish in it. I actually had to go through the experience of learning Irish from scratch as an adult, because I was working as a primary school teacher, and having grown up in England, I didn't speak a word of Irish, but you have to speak Irish to work as a teacher here. So I was 28, 29 when I started learning Irish, and it was really, really hard, as you can imagine. So I actually wrote a story about that called How to Learn Irish in 17 Steps, and I threw in a few phrases of Irish there, but again, I had to get help with that because my Irish is still pretty shocking, so I had someone help me with the spelling and everything for that.
And I love the humour in that story. It's very funny, the grapplings with the Irish language and
yeah,
that. It's,
I was
really
able to
funny.
See the funny side looking back. It wasn't very funny at the time.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your relationship maybe now with the Irish language, because I remember I read an essay that you wrote, and I think you said that at one stage you hated Irish at one stage. And what about now, I suppose? Did you ever write in Irish?
No, I haven't. It's something I'd like like to aim for, though. Yeah, I've actually been a bit lazy with Irish. I had to pass these big exams for my teaching, and unfortunately, since I've passed those, I've been a bit lazy, really, about speaking Irish and reading Irish, but I would like to get back into it. Yeah, that would be, like, an ultimate goal, to write a short story in Irish. It's something maybe to aim for. I did end up really enjoying it, though. I started off, as you said, really almost resenting the Irish language because I had to pass these exams basically to keep my job. I had 3 years in which to learn Irish to pretty much university entrance level. And I really hated it. But towards the end, though, I went and I spent some time in the Gaeltacht. I went out to Connemara, and just the people I met out there and the real sense of community out there was wonderful, and eventually managed to pass these exams, and yeah, I ended up really, really enjoying Irish. So I'd like to try and get back into it. But how's your Irish, Danielle?
My Irish is not so good.
No.
I won't be writing anything in Irish
because people learn it from when they're 4 years old until they're 18, don't they? And the number of people I'd say to them, oh, would you help me with this? Or, and the number of people that say, oh, no, I wouldn't be confident in Irish is, what are we doing wrong in the teaching? That I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's one of the funny things as well in that story, where the Brazilian woman expects Irish people to be good at Irish, but no, actually.
That's
a very funny story.
Does anyone have to ask us
questions? Donna, I'd like to know, how's your book coming along? How's it shaping up? We're looking forward to reading it.
Oh, the next one?
Yeah.
Well, I wrote it, which is good news for me. So, there is a book. I'm working away on rewrites at the moment. It took me a long time to kind of work on it from different angles that weren't working, and, you know, drafts and bits and pieces. I'm a very messy writer. And then last year it kind of came together and took shape as one story, and I wrote over 6 or 7 weeks, I wrote a huge chunk. I wrote maybe, I don't know, somewhere between 70,000 and 80,000 words over 6 to 7 weeks, which was a really unusual experience for me as a short story writer, because, you know, that was really, really different to the process of writing the short stories. So it's not ready, it's not presentable yet, but I'm working away.
Do you find in some ways that it's easier to write something longer compared to a short story?
I think there's maybe
different.
It's different. I found at the beginning of writing the novel that the process was very similar to writing short stories, and I was thinking, what are people talking about? This is very much the same, writing the two things. And then after a while, once I moved past the initial stages, I found the novel was quite a different thing to write.
Mm-hmm.
I think once you get to a certain point and the story takes off with the novel, well, I found anyway, it doesn't require the same number of drafts to get things right. Whereas with a short story, it's almost like you're writing code and you change one word in a sentence and it has a ripple effect throughout, you know, four other paragraphs.
So
it's like a very complex puzzle. Whereas with a novel, you have more space to, to fix something. And you add a little bit here and there.
Yeah, because they do say it's the high wire act of literature, don't they? The short story.
You've a novel written, have you?
I've like three terrible novels from when I was from when I was younger. Because when I was a teenager and that, I thought, I always wanted to be a writer. I always loved stories, loved it from when I was very young. And I thought if you wanted to be a writer, you have to write novels. I didn't really know about short stories, and so, I have a few sort of failed novels hidden away on the computer somewhere, but I wouldn't be bringing those into the world now, but I'd like to hopefully write a good novel someday,
What made you choose the short story format, or was it just something you fell into, or did you make a conscious choice and want to write short stories?
As I said, I started out with novels. I wasn't really aware of short stories. I don't know, growing up at home, my mum and dad are great readers, but they had novels. You know, it was novels on the bookshelves. It wasn't short stories. And then I went to a workshop at the Irish Writers' Centre with Dave Lorden, who's a fantastic writer, a fantastic creative writing teacher, and it was really Dave that introduced me to the short story form and just kind of fell in love with it then, and I've been writing them ever since. How are you doing?
Yeah, I don't know why. It wasn't that I sat down and thought about it and said I'm going to choose short stories. I think maybe when I started attempting to write, that this was just the shape that my ideas went into, and they were a particular length. And they were much shorter when I started out. They were maybe 2,000 or 3,000 words in the beginning, then they got longer and longer. And now when I write a short story, it could be anything up to 9,000 or 10,000 words.
Yeah.
So there was that movement from writing quite short pieces in the beginning to writing longer.
So which do you think you prefer?
Well, at the moment I'm writing both novel and short story, and then I'm writing short stories alongside working on the novel.
Right.
So I couldn't see myself not doing either of them now. I think they're two different things, and I go back and forth between them.
Have you ever written any more flash? I was going to say, can you remember you had a flash fiction story in, you know, the Fish anthology?
Yeah.
And that's really short because that's only one page. So do you do that from time to time? Is it?
I do.
Like,
do you know what? It's coincidentally now, I was only thinking to myself, like, you haven't written any flash for a while, and someone contacted me and said, would you have a flash fiction piece? So I'm working on a couple of them at the moment. Yeah. I like them. They're a different thing. Again, I find.
They're really hard. I find I could spend weeks, months over one page.
Yeah, 300 words.
You've got like this little tiny thing to show for it at the end. It's just because you've such a small word count, every word has to earn its place. But they're really rewarding then when you feel as if you've kind of got it right.
Yeah, I like them. I'm enjoying doing them again at the moment now. And I think, they move. My flash fictions are moving closer to poetry, so when I'm writing my flash fictions, I can find kind of rhythms coming in much more strongly than when I'm writing longer pieces of fiction.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I know now there's more people working sort of in hybrid forms, like you would have people writing something and submitting it as flash fiction, submitting the same thing as prose poetry for a different journal or whatever, and there is that lovely kind of overlap, which is really interesting, I think.
And is the flash fiction only published like in journals?
It's mostly in journals, although I've noticed now that there are anthologies of flash fiction being published, and there are some people who are publishing collections of flash fiction.
I think it's an American writer, I don't remember her name now, it's not Larry Moore. You know who writes really short?
Lydia Davis.
Yeah. She would be famous for just very short pieces.
Sometimes just a paragraph.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Can I ask you, had your work written for a long time without even the thought of publishing? And when you did decide to publish, did you go looking for an editor, or did somebody come looking for you, or did you go looking for a publisher? And did you both publish in Ireland, or did you go outside Ireland? And did you have, sorry, so many
Well, in my case, when I started writing, I had no idea really that I would have a book at all, and even the idea that I would have a book published seemed a very strange thing to me. I fell into writing, but it kind of came about in an unplanned way because I was working as a solicitor for years and years, and I became ill very suddenly. And when I was ill, I started writing, and the writing took off for me, which was just something I had never expected. And I ended up never going back to legal practice. So I was publishing in journals for a couple of years first. And I would recommend that to anybody who is starting out writing, to send your work out, and you really need to be sending work out regularly, I think. And it was through being published in a journal, the Stinging Fly Journal, that I got my collection. It took me a couple of years after the editor first approached me and said, would you be interested in working towards a collection? But it took me a couple of years after that to actually have a collection ready. So I was years writing stories, really. I suppose my book was published in Ireland in 2015, and the early story in it was written in 2011, so it was a while in the making, really.
Yeah, and a similar experience in that, publishing in journals and things like that first. Yeah, as Danielle says, I definitely would recommend it. It's a great way to kind of start out if you're looking to get into writing. As I said, I did a workshop at the Irish Writers' Centre, and I never would have really considered sending anything to be published before then, but I got a lot of encouragement from everyone at the Irish Writers' Centre, and started sending to journals and different competitions and got a few different shortlistings and stuff like that. And then I was commissioned to write a story for Young Irelanders, which was an anthology by New Ireland Books, and it was just like a showcase of different young writers. So the story in there is the one about the Brazilian girl learning Irish, and they really liked that, and it was kind of like word of mouth. Someone said to me, oh, the editors at New Ireland seem to really like your stuff, you should send them your collection. And at that stage, I didn't really have a collection as such. I just had random kind of scattered stories. I never would have thought of putting them together or having a book published. But I put together a selection of stories and sent them to the editors, and they were really interested. And yeah, got my collection then with New Ireland. So yeah, so my book is just published in Ireland with New Ireland Books. So that's kind of the story so far anyway. But that is the good thing about short stories, I think, though, is that you can publish them with different journals, you can kind of get feedback on your stories and then try and publish a collection, instead of kind of working away in a novel for several years and then trying to publish kind of cold, as it were. With short stories, you can kind of ease into the publishing world, which is a good thing, I think.
Yeah.
I have two questions, one for each. I enjoy the readings. The books wouldn't be particularly I pick up, but the readings made it very interesting. In the first one there, you had an awful lot of detail. Did it take you long to write that section?
The section with the skull and the bucket?
Yeah.
Well, that section that I read, and I'm thinking about the different pieces in that. That story came about from my youngest child. I was putting him to bed one night and he said, are there dinosaurs on other planets? So it was kind of like I had that the central piece of that came from an actual question one of my kids asked. And the skull part of it, the kids and my husband went for a walk in a forest that's near our house one day, and they came home and they brought this skull, and we figured it was an animal skull and we didn't know what it was. So there was an actual skull that I saw and we had in our house and I was looking at it. So it came from that. Now, those two things I've just talked about, the question and the skull, there was a few months between them, actually. So the question lodged in my head, and then different little bits and pieces for the story were starting to form around it, and I wasn't sure exactly what I'd do with it. And then they brought the skull home, and I put the two things together. So it took a few months to take shape of the story, and it took another few months after that to be drafting it and redrafting it. And I'd say I could have had 40 drafts, but more, you know, of that particular one. So I'm quite a slow writer. It's just a quite a messy process. But I don't mind that, because I've discovered if I keep all the stuff I throw away, I use it in other stories. So I kind of recycle all the bits that I cut out.
Very good. My second question is, I liked your introduction where the mother and the newborn child, strangers, I like that. It's just a small point, with more curiosity than anything. You were in Dunleary and you were talking about going to the Rotunda Hospital. A topic just jumped into my mind, like, why not go to Hollis Street or somewhere?
I don't know, actually. Yeah, that's probably...
There was no
reason for that,
yeah.
Really. I'm trying to think why.
Because there was a scene in Snapper, and if you see that DVD, and I think he's bringing her to the hospital, and they're going through the streets of Dublin.
Yeah.
So they show you different streets.
Yeah.
But the way they organised it was, well, he wouldn't go that route if he was going to the...
Yeah.
That just reminded me of...
I think it sort of shows you, like... how my perspective has changed. It's funny when you, short stories, I think of them as like little time capsules, you know? I look back on a short story that I wrote 3 years ago, and it's like looking back at an old photograph, you know? I say, oh, that's how I was thinking at that time. So that was written about 3 years ago. Honestly, I probably didn't know of any other maternity hospitals in Dublin, and there you go, you spotted a hole in my research. Honestly, a few years ago, whereas now I could name them all for you, you know? But it just shows you, I mean, yeah, like your perspective changes, you know, when you look back at stories and think, God, I would do that a bit differently now. But that's the beauty in them as well, I think, that you have that sort of moment preserved, really. But yeah, thanks for pointing that out.
Okay then, so it just remains to thank Danielle and Roshi for their enlightening and entertaining session, and we wish them well with their new writings, and we look forward to reading them, and maybe you'll come back in the future.
Thank you for listening to the Dublin City Public Libraries and Archives podcast. To hear more, please subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud. You can also visit our website, dublincitypubliclibraries.ie, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.